Welcome to Passport to Everywhere with Indigare's Melissa Biggs Bradley.
Melissa is the founder and CEO of Indigare, a travel and media company committed to inspiring and empowering people to change their lives and the world through travel, while having a positive impact on the places they visit. On the show, Melissa will transport you to dream destinations, share the latest travel news and trends, and introduce you to the most extraordinary people she has met on the road.
We are not different people in different countries. It's not that. That's not the important thing in life. The important thing in life is understanding that we're all together on the same boat.
Follow her behind the scenes to the world's most legendary hotels and join us as she explores the future of travel.
Award-winning travel writer Francisca Mattioli has authored over a dozen books that have been published worldwide and translated into several languages. She's also collaborated with National Geographic, Condé Nast Traveler, Louis Vuitton, and more, making quite a name for herself as an ever-captivating storyteller. Her latest book, Copacabana Palace, Where Rio Starts, was released in December of 2023. And in it, she couples vibrant photography with iconic stories from the Brazilian hotel's 100-year existence to really make the legendary Rio de Janeiro Hotel come to life. Francisca was born in Chile to a Scottish mother and a Chilean father. She was raised among Chilean cowboys, and she's collected stories for much of her life. Her passion for exploration was first ignited by her mother's exquisite photography and her father's varied tales of adventures. Her own journey led her from Chile to Brazil and on to Paris, where she's currently based. Through her writing, Francisca beautifully captures the spirit of discovery. She uses her memories and experiences to transport her readers. And today I'm excited to dive deeper into her writing, to discuss the glamour of travel, to probe at the truths of humanity, and more. Plus, on this week's Indigare Insight, I'm going to share some ways you can go back into history by visiting some of my favorite house museums and gardens. All this and more coming up now on Passport to Everywhere.
Join Melissa on the journey. You're listening to Passport to Everywhere. Here's your host, Melissa Biggs Bradley.
Francisca, thank you so much for joining me today. I often say that travel is in my DNA, or it's in my family history, because my parents met while they were both traveling. But I think you have maybe it more of a lineage even than I do of being in your destiny going to be a traveler and explorer. Can you share a little bit about your family's history of travel? I love the story of your grandfather living in Paris and the Rue du Louvre. Will you share that story with us?
Yes, with pleasure. I am Chilean. My mother is Scottish. And it's true that my family has been traveling. All the members of my family have been traveling all their lives. My mother left Scotland when she was very young to marry my father in Chile. And then we lived in Chile, and my family was lucky enough to be able to travel the world. And they used to come to Europe very often. They stayed at the Hotel du Louvre, for example. They were used to stay in hotels at those times. Some people were lucky enough to be able to stay, really, and live in hotels. And I always had stories in my family about travelers, fantastic adventures, things that nobody would have done at that time. So, of course, I suppose it was a huge influence in my work. And now I use it in my books. And it's in my, as you say, it's in my blood, absolutely.
And is it true that one of your grandfathers died at the Hotel du Louvre?
Exactly. And the story is very funny in a way, if I may say, because yes, he lived at the Hotel du Louvre. My grandfather and my grandmother lived also at the Hotel du Louvre. I should live there because, I mean, it's a destiny. I don't know what I'm doing in a flat. When the bill, the last year of he spent there, my great-grandfather lived at the Hotel du Louvre, and when the bill was sent to my family in Chile, they were all very upset because they had to pay for 1 or 2 years that he has spent at the Hotel du Louvre. But a month later, they receive another note from the hotel saying that he has been such an agreeable and funny guest that the hotel was offering that year to the family. So it was a relief for my family in Chile to know that they were not going to have to pay for 1, 2, or 3 years of the stay of my grandfather, my great-grandfather in the Hotel du Louvre. So that is how it started, more or less, you know.
So they forgave the whole bill.
Exactly.
Because he was a good guest.
It was a great gift because he was a very original traveler. He arrived with a lot of suitcases. He was a very special person. So
that's
they loved
amazing.
That.
That's amazing. And so then when you left Chile, because you left Chile when you were quite young, you also moved into the Hotel du Louvre.
Exactly, because my family knew that hotel. Each time they were used to our name because my maiden name is extremely complicated. So they were used to our name. And the first place where my parents thought we should go, because at first we thought we were going to stay in France for just a few months after the political situation got more complex, so it was very different. But at first we thought we were going to stay here 3, 4, 6 months, so we decided to settle at the Hotel du Louvre, and we brought with us a lot of our furniture because we came on a liner. It took months, weeks to arrive here, and we almost push the furniture from the room, and we start putting our own furniture. So we lived there with my sister, my mother, father, and my grandparents. So all the family was living at the Hotel du Louvre. I must say that at that time also, the Hotel du Louvre, today it's very different from what it was at that time. At that time, you still had beautiful shops just around the Grand Magasin du Louvre. They don't exist anymore. And also the Rue de l'Opéra and the Comédie Française, they're still there, but they were very different. You had a lot of shops. It was a different kind of life. So, and for them and my parents, my father has done part of his studies here in France. So that is why they decided to come here. They loved France, really, and Europe.
Wow. So then you went to school here and grew up in France at that point.
Yes, absolutely. And the address I gave at school was the Hotel du Louvre. So nobody has ever seen that. I think I was really like a very strange, I must have seemed very strange to all the pupils in my class. Because when the teachers were asking where I was living, I said at the hotel, and we stayed there several years. So that was quite an experience.
So at what point did you know that travel was going to be a career and more than just a passion for you?
Well, in fact, when I was 20, like a lot of people of that age, I had no idea what I was going to do with my life. And suddenly a friend of mine said, why don't you start? I loved writing all my life. I was very good at school. I was very bad at everything, but I was very good at writing. I love making up stories because when you are alone in a country, you know, you need an escape. Our situation was complicated, was complex. And I was always making up stories, inventing stories. And when I had to choose a profession. I had no idea what I was going to do. And suddenly a friend said, why don't you write about your travels? Because you've been traveling so much with your family and you have that history and all that. But I've never seen that as a job, because for me it was something natural. And then I started proposing articles to magazines. They accept them immediately. And from there on, after that, I decided maybe I could do a book with that. So I went to see a publisher and they said, well, that's a great idea. So we published the stories that were already published in magazines. And that is how it started, very naturally, in fact. I was lucky. I was very lucky because I arrived at a good time. Not a lot of people have been where I've been. I had the opportunity to write about South America. At that time, very few people went to South America. Nobody knew the Atacama Desert or Patagonia, not at all. And I have been there with my family several times, so I could write about places like that that were very different and unknown. There were no tourists at that time. So that was the beginning of it.
Then you started traveling with your husband for National Geographic. But in those cases, you were going to places that were not really for travelers to go to. They were often wars, sort of just after war zones or areas of great conflict. Can you talk a little bit about that period and what it was like to be there?
Yes, it was intense, of course. National Geographic for me was a goal. I was passionate by the magazine, of course, by the quality of the stories, the quality of the photographers. It was really, when I started doing my job, it's really something I wanted to do, work with them. So I remember the first story I wrote, it was about Rwanda. At the time, my husband was working with the French doctors and he was going to Rwanda just after the genocide. And I said to myself, this is a story really I want to tell. And I went to see the editor of National Geographic, and I proposed to write a story about Rwanda at that period of time that was very specific. And also I knew that it was, of course, it wasn't open to tourism, because nowadays when I see Rwanda and the gorillas, safaris and all that, it's totally different. But at the time, of course, it was totally closed and nobody had the idea of going there. It was, of course, dangerous, rather dangerous at least. And so I said to myself, this is really going to be the experience of a lifetime. And of course, as we were among the few people who could go there, the people of National Geographic were very excited about the idea. So I went with my husband and I wrote a story about surgeons operating there, but also about how was the life after the genocide. And I tried, because it's always very difficult to describe a country where you don't live exactly, where you don't live. I tried my best to explain how was the situation there at that moment. And it was really, of course, it goes without saying, an extremely intense and extremely strong experience. And it helped me a lot after in my everyday work and also in my life. It changed my life, really. Well, I suppose that all the people who have lived that kind of experience will feel the same.
Can you talk a little bit more about how it changed your life?
Yes, of course. First, I understood something I knew already with my parents, because I come from different backgrounds and my parents come from different countries. But there are things that you feel and there are things that after a while you know. And something I understood very quickly is that, in fact, the humanity is more or less the same everywhere. We have all the same aspirations. We all have the same ambitions. We all want a correct life. We want to live a quiet life. We want to have our children have the best education. We want to eat. We want to drink. It seems silly to say that like that, but when you haven't been to different places, like we have the chance to go or where we've been, you don't realize that we're all part of the same community. And I think that is very important that we repeat and repeat that again and again. We are not different people in different countries. It's not that. That's not the important thing in life. The important thing in life is understanding that we're all together on the same boat. And even if those people, of course, were living an absolute terrible and dramatic situation, when I was speaking with them, I realized that we were speaking the same language. And that after, when I was traveling in totally different conditions, I remember that. And that gave me the opportunity to connect to everybody very easily because I had lived that already, you see?
Yeah, that's amazing. And after that Rwanda story, you continued to go to some places that were in conflict with your husband. Are there ways that travel to tougher places like Ethiopia and Rwanda after crises have kind of changed other than your attitude, which I think I completely agree with you. I think that's one of the joys of travel is mm-hmm. that we do realize that despite superficial differences, whether it's language or looks or culture, we are very much the same people. Mm-hmm. Are there other ways that travel in sort of hardship changed your perspective as a traveler? Because then you've gone on to write a lot about glamorous, extraordinary travel. So you've done both spectrums.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I went to all those countries for more or less 10 years. So it was a very rewarding, but at the same time, an exhausting experience. Of course, well, as I said, it gave me the opportunity to be in connection with a lot of people, and that helped me a lot. But after that, I realized also that in your life, you have periods of times, you know, where you fit with a certain ambition, some things that you want to do. And then suddenly, I don't know why, maybe because of the experience or you change your mind or you evolute or you grow older, you want to do something else. And in my case, after 10 years with my husband, we decided that we want another kind of life because it was, I don't know if I'm going to say that in the right way, but there is a sort of adrenaline also, you know, going to those places because it's so intense. It's so different from the everyday life that after that, it's rather difficult to adapt to a normal life. And that, in a way, frightened us. And as a couple, we decided to do things differently. My husband, for example, he decided to create his own humanitarian association. But also, as my parents were growing older, and I was discussing with them about a lot of things, I said to myself, now maybe it's time to celebrate also the joy of traveling, maybe because I've seen the difficulty of traveling, and I wanted something a little bit more, how would I say, not so serious, not so difficult, you see. I'm not saying that what I do today is not difficult because it's a job, and when you're a professional, everything is it's hard work. But I wanted something different, and in that sense, it was a transition. In fact, to my books and to other kind of travels.
So, what was your first book?
My first book was about hotels because as I had lived in a hotel, I don't know, someone must have said to me, why don't you write? You know, I always pick ideas when I'm discussing with a friend. And someone said, why don't you write about hotels? Because you've been living in a hotel, so for you it's going to be easy. I didn't realize at the time that it was going to be a job and it's not going to be so easy. But that was my first book. And also it's rather funny because at the beginning I was able to write about my family. I have all a page about the story I told you about my great-grandfather. My grandfather had the Hotel du Louvre. So it's a book about hotels, but at the same time it's a book about stories because most of my books are books about stories. That's what I like. So it's not a document, it's not a journalistic work at all.
And now you've written 14 books, I think, right?
Exactly.
So what is the latest one?
The latest one is about the Copacabana Palace. In fact, my family has been going to the Copacabana Palace since 1923, the date of the opening. I must be the fifth generation to go there. And when I was proposed, when the Belmont group came and proposed, because it's the centenary, last year was the centenary of the hotel, when they proposed to me to write the book, I found it really fantastic to be able to write about something that my family has lived, because I have, I think, 20 or 15 stories in the book, and I really wanted each story to be personal. Of course, it's about a place, but it's also about Rio, and my husband and I, we lived in Rio, so we know the city very well. I love the Brazilian spirit. I love the Carioca spirit. I think we have a lot of lessons to learn from them. They have a joie de vivre, as we say in France, that is really amazing, a philosophy of life. And it's also about a place, but it's a place that is totally connected to a city. And that is what I wanted to do. I wanted to do a book that is not only about a hotel, but a hotel that has something to do with the city and with the spirit. It's really a spirit. So every story starts with a different point of view I have of the city, of the place, of the hotel. And I have a funny story in that sense, because my grandfather, the one who lived at the Hotel du Louvre, when one day he was going to the Copacabana Palace from Santiago, from Chile, because we lived in Chile, and he was mistaken for the actor, the American actor Tyrone Power, because they looked very much alike. And when my grandfather arrived, the people there thought that he was Tyrone Power. So he started signing autographs as he was Tyrone Power. He was a very funny man. He always had a lot of stories and he had a lot of humor. So that was the first time I heard in our family the name Copacabana Palace. So I wrote about that at the beginning of the book. And it was nice to connect the hotel to my family and to a story like that, and show that a hotel like that, you know, has been appealing and to a family for several generations, and that there are still places like that exist, where people go on going, they still go generation after generation. I think it's very important nowadays.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And the one before the Copacabana one was Extraordinary Voyages.
Exact.
So
yes.
Will you explain the idea behind that one as well?
Yes, it's a book about 20 or 30, I don't remember, different extraordinary travel stories. Most of the travels in that book I experimented myself. And it was a book I did with Louis Vuitton. In the book, you have some of their archives that are really beautiful. And at the same time, I wrote those stories that don't have directly to do with the archives of Louis Vuitton, but they have had to do with extraordinary voyages and extraordinary experiences, because a travel, it's about the experience that you're living. So you have an experience in Alaska, another in Montana, another in France, all over the world. And it's nice because I was able to write about things that I knew very well.
And if you had to pick one or two of the most extraordinary voyages or trips in that book to embark on yourself, what would some of those be?
Well, I think I love adventure, you know, in general. So it would be an adventure in Alaska, for example, but it can be the first balloon that was sent to the air here near Paris, or it can be a road trip in the United States, or the America's Cup, for example, because the stories are very, very different, and they go from the beginning of last century to nowadays. So you have all kind of stories and adventures. So It's your question is tricky because most of them, they're for me, they're extremely different and extremely exciting.
Yeah,
I love all of them. In fact, I would like to. I would like to redo or do every one of them. Really,
that's fantastic.
This is Passport to Everywhere. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Passport to Everywhere, and I'm your host, Melissa Biggs Bradley. Joining me today is award-winning author Francisca Mattioli to discuss the golden age of travel, the importance of finding humor in unexpected situations, truly living in the present, and more. And later on this week's Indigari Insight, I share my favorite historic house museums and gardens, as well as some that our travel community has suggested to me. Plus, I have a travel news update that will impact anyone who has a delayed or canceled flight. So be sure to stick around. Now back to the show.
Passport to Everywhere with Melissa Biggs Bradley continues. Listen to new episodes every Thursday on all podcast platforms.
Okay, and you've also written about legendary hotels. One of your books is on the 100 sort of most iconic hotels around the world. I'm going to ask again, can you pick out of that some of those that are favorites? Obviously, I would imagine that the Copacabana is one, since you just did a whole book on it. But
yes,
some others in that book that you think still hold up to their legendary status.
Well, there is one I'm thinking of because I love that part of the United States. And my husband and I, we rented a house in Carmel, so I love Big Sur. I love that part of the world. It's the Beverly Hills and Bungalows, because what I like in those hotels, and it's that it has maintained a certain kind of glamour, you know. I think that is something that unfortunately would disappear one day. And when you arrive in that hotel, the Pink Palace, it's really like being in the 50s with, of course, all the modernity. It has been redone, beautifully redone and everything. But you feel a very special atmosphere. And also, I would like to say that in those hotels, you can go and have a drink. You don't have to stay there, because a lot of people think it's a hotel where I will never be able to go. But you can have a drink, you can visit the place, you can walk around, and just that, just when you arrive there, the way you are welcomed, the way the people smile at you, it's the same with the Copacabana Palace, because it's very important, the people who work in those hotels also, you know. They have a certain way. Most of the people who have been working at the Copacabana Palace, like at the Beverly Hills and Bungalows, they've been working there for 30, 40 years. They've known your family, they know your children. You can say that, of course, of a motel too. And in those places, you have really a sort of a family atmosphere. And what I like, it's the way they maintain the history and that ambiance that is very, very specific to those places. So that is the first hotel that comes to my mind. But of course, there are a lot of others in South America. You have a lot of places like that are still more or less the same they were in the 50s. And I think that is fabulous, to be able to maintain that atmosphere and that's special ambiance.
Yeah, there's a certain kind of thrill, as you said, of pulling into the Beverly Hills Hotel. And you're totally right. I think I had lunch there for 10 years before I ever got to stay in the hotel. And,
yes,
and you still
exactly
have that sort of, as they say in French, the frisson of,
absolutely,
of excitement.
It's very special. You know, you can go there a million times, and each time you feel the same, like being in a Billy Wilder movie. You know, it's fabulous. I love old movies, and I love American cinema. And I was reading the biography of Billy Wilder, and he explains all that and that ambiance and atmosphere of that time. And we'll never leave that again. And so going there is just going back to a moment that exists in our imagination, in fact.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's really unique. It's quite unique.
Well, it's interesting because your books celebrate a sort of golden age of travel. And as we've been talking, you mentioned that you love adventure, as do I. You know, I wrote my book on safaris. I love adventure. I also love glamour. And I think the golden age of travel had both of those things. I think that's one of the reasons that what appeals to me in many ways about whether it's being in Paris, which I love, or being on safari, which I love, they both have some of the sort of excitement of a bygone era, because mm-hmm. there's a sense of history still being appreciated or being exact. Made. And I'm curious, you know, as you think about experiences that still give that sense of, you know, really exciting, glamorous travel, what are some of the ways? One of them is a great glamorous hotel. I think another is going on a true adventure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
But are there other examples that you can think of today that capture that same kind of excitement of the golden age?
Well, it's very true what you're saying. And one thing that is very true is that there are very different kind of glamour. Of course, you have those wonderful hotels, but it's also a question of slowing down for me. You know, when you are in a place, for example, you were mentioning safaris, or you mentioned the wild spaces. When you are in a country where you have the time, because that is something that for me goes with the golden age of travel. At that time, the people had the time to enjoy their travels. For example, when you were on a plane, you discuss with other people. It was a social experience also. Today, you go on your plane, you hurry, you put your luggage, you sit, you want to sleep. I see people. I've been, like you, so many times on a plane. I always enjoy it. A lot of people, they put immediately the mask and they start sleeping.
That's me. Sorry.
No way. I enjoy every little thing. Everything is it's new for me. And for example, for me, a wild space and slowing down and taking the time to enjoy the moment, for me, that is glamorous. You see, it's like being in all again. It's like being in a movie with Ava Gardner and Grace Kelly, Mogambo. And also, the glamour for me goes with a certain attitude. The people used at that time, when my mother, she's 93 now, and she traveled a lot. And when she explains how she used to travel, she had a certain way of dressing. She dressed for travel. She had her vanity case with her, a little maquillage and all that, her makeup. And it was slow. Everything was slow. You know, you had time. So that also goes together. I think that also is part of a glamorous life. It's enjoying the moment, being in the present, you know. I think that is very important. And I think that people should understand and learn how to be in the present nowadays, you know?
I know, I think that's fantastic advice, because I think you're totally right. It isn't just where we go, but how we are in the place and how we are appreciating the moment. Now, I do sleep on the plane because I want to get to the next place and enjoy that place.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. But I think you're entirely right. It's the approach that we bring. You know, we can decide to get up and have a wonderful social breakfast with the people that we're traveling with and enjoy our time and enjoy how lucky we are to get to be in a different place. Or we can try and be at home on our iPads the whole time we're in a place. And then, of course, you miss all of it.
Yes. I met a lot of people during my travel, and I have a lot of friends that I met in a cafe or on the plane, because I speak with people very easily. My parents are from different nationalities, you know, at home we were used to speak a million languages at the same time, so it's not a big deal for me. Sometimes the people are afraid, or they don't want to speak with you because they think you're going to start asking personal questions or I don't know what. But for me, it's just a moment in life. You don't need to see them if you don't want to, but at least the moment is nice and you never know what can happen. Yeah. And a lot of people I met during my travels, I still see them today.
Yeah, no, and I actually think so often I've met some incredible people on my travels, and not even some have become friends because you are at sort of an almost more naked version or true exact version of yourself often when you're traveling. But I've also had fascinating conversations on a plane with people that I never see again, but who were willing to share very interesting stories of their life.
Yes, so, it's true. And what I like also is that very often the people are aware that it's going to be just for a moment. And that makes it even more exciting because you know that sometimes you're never going to meet those people again. When you are at the bottom of Alaska or in Australia, I don't know where, in the middle of the bush, there are very little chances that you're going to meet the people again. You know that. And maybe that makes the conversation even more fascinating because you really want to catch everything you can from the people you meet and really enjoy the moment, you know. So I think that is part of traveling also. It's a communication. It's a lot of people don't understand that. They just want to take photos and bring pictures or films or whatever. But the moment you share with other people, especially now, we are all on the internet, we're all on our mobiles, the connection is getting more and more virtual. In fact, we are not discussing a real big discussion, you know, even when you don't agree with someone, it's fantastic. You always learn something and you learn so much more from someone's experience that you can learn on the internet. You never know what is there, but you know that the person who's speaking to you, they're sincere. Because they are themselves, as you say. You are yourself when you're traveling because you're away from your everyday life. And you don't care because, as I said, maybe you'll never see those people again. So it's easy. Things are easy. And I think that's one of the best moments when you're traveling.
Well, and it's interesting because, as you said, in tough places, you're reminded that we're part of this, how much we're alike. And in some ways, having these sort of conversations with strangers, these can be very intimate moments with strangers, is another way to be reminded of the same thing, of how much as humanity we share and we can learn from each other.
Exactly. And from all backgrounds, because, for example, one of my best friends in Rio, he comes from a very difficult place near Rio, and others are socialites and others are people who work in the street. You don't make the difference. The people are fascinating in general. Most of the people, if you're kind, if you're willing to exchange experience and ideas, or even say hello, hola, tudo bem, a little thing like that, there is a connection there. And that is, for me, that is the interest of life. If not, we would have been stayed in our flat in front of our desk. I do a very lonely job. Writing is a solitary occupation. And also that is part of the fact that I want to meet other people. When I stop a book, I want to speak with you. I want to share my experience. It's very important for me. So I think in life, it should be the same, of course.
I completely agree. Now, do you have any travel heroes or role models? Or you've done lots of research on interesting explorers and adventurers. Are there some that are your favorites?
I have some travelers that are not with us anymore, but I would have loved to meet them. For example, I'm thinking of Peter Fleming. He was a writer. He was also the brother of Ian Fleming, the creator of James Bond. But I read some of his books. He went to very different parts of the world. Something that I really like about him is that he had a lot of humor. And I believe that when you travel, wherever you are, and especially when you are in difficult situation, because you, when you like adventure, it happens. You are suddenly in a situation that you don't know how to handle it. You need humor. And I noticed that a lot of people who travel, who work in the travel business, or who travel for their pleasure, they don't have a lot of humor very often. They take those things very seriously. And Peter Fleming, when you read his books, they're full of humor. And I always thought that he would have been a fantastic travel companion, because people like that, you can get out of any situation with people like that. So that would be that's the first example that comes to my mind.
I think actually, Francisca, that's such a good example, because if you had I don't have a list of what I think makes the perfect travel companion, but I think intuitively I'm attracted to people with certain qualities if I'm going to travel with them. And humor absolutely has to be one, because as you said, I always think that when you travel, you're giving yourself up to the vicissitudes of life. You just never know if your flight's going to take off, if anything is going to go right. And the best way to be, aside from being flexible, is to at least have a perspective and a sense of humor on it.
It's true. Yes.
That's so fun. Okay, so I would love to know if you have any travel rituals or habits, because you are as much a professional traveler as anybody, and you've been high and low and all over the world. Are there certain tricks or rituals that you use that whenever you travel?
First of all, I always take my luggage with me. That is the rule.
Me too.
I think that is the first thing. I travel light. That is not very glamorous. I should have tons of luggage, but I don't think that nowadays that is possible. Or if it's possible, it's a nightmare, because anyway, you have to wait for the luggage at the end of the trip, and I don't like doing that. And also nowadays, if you have forgotten something, there is always a little shop where you can buy a T-shirt or something like that. So that is the first thing. Then I always bring a book with me, or several, for the reason I explained before, because if you are waiting hours for a delayed flight, or if something happens, at least you have a good book with you. And I'm very organized. I am a very organized person. When you see my desk, it's a mess. But when I have to do my luggage, I'm very organized, because I hate opening my suitcase and finding tons of things one on top of the other. And it's a waste of time.
When you pack, now I'll get into some of the details. I use packing cubes. I like to have different sort of zipped things to keep
things
in.
Yes.
Do you do the same?
Yes, absolutely.
And do you fold or do you roll? I just fold my clothes
in the
cubes.
No, I fold my clothes the same. Okay. Yes. There are things that I always bring. As you can see, I don't have exactly the South American skin. So I always bring a very high level of sunscreen and protection. That is something I think it's very important. It seems like a detail, but when you're traveling to places like Australia or Alaska or places like that, the weather can be very difficult. So it's extremely important to have a extremely good protection and not worry about all those kinds of things.
Do you have brands that you love?
Most of them are pharmaceutical brands, like Eucerin, or like I discover lately Skinceutical, I think, and
they have a very good sunscreen.
Very, very good. And also bring all kind of clothes. I bring jeans, and I bring party dresses also, because you never know where you're going to be, you know. And a party dress is very easy to bring. You have just a long dress that you can wear for a lot of different occasions, And suddenly, if you're invited to a wedding, even a very simple wedding, you're happy to be able to dress up. And when you've been in jeans all day, it's nice at the end of the day to put some makeup and put a nice dress. So I think that is the little glamorous part that you can still carry with you.
That's fantastic. Okay, so where is left on your list? Where do you still want to travel to?
A lot of places. In fact, there are a lot of places where I would like to return. It's more that.
Okay.
For example, with my husband, we did a lot of road trips across America. I would like to do that again if I'm capable. I'm a very, very bad driver. He's the driver, in fact. And so I would love to do something like that. Australia was really a fantastic experience. I was speaking about Alaska. We went to Alaska several times and we love the place. South America, I know, of course, a big part of South America, but not the center of it. So I would love to go there also. It depends on the mood, you know. Yeah. Suddenly, because I don't have children, so I can decide from one day to another. And sometimes I said to myself, look, next month or next week, why don't we go there? And we just go. So it depends what happens or what I want to do, you know.
And what are some of your favorite spots in South America?
Of course, Chile. I love my country, really. It's geographically speaking, it's absolutely fabulous because, as you know, it's the big, long snake, 4,000 kilometers from north to south. You have the Atacama Desert.
Which is one of my favorite places I've ever been.
It's fantastic because, as you know, it's not only a desert, but it's full of geysers. You have Valle de la Luna, the Moon Valley. You have so many different landscapes.
The salt flats and the geysers and the hot springs that you can... It's amazing.
I've never been though during what we call the Deserto Florido, is the when there are flowers, because you know you have seeds that are brought by the wind, and suddenly if you have a little water, the seeds bloom, and you have that pink desert. I would love to be there once. And then the other places in South America, Colombia, for example, or places like that, maybe Central South America too. So, and parts of Brazil also that I don't know, the north I don't know very well. Those are the parts. Maybe I should do a road trip and go from one place to the other for several months. That would be a good idea.
Really adventurous. That would be very fun. Unfortunately, I'm not a great driver either, so we may have to bring your husband or mine.
My goodness. Both. That'd be bizarre.
I think mine might just meet us at the hotels.
He will read the map.
That would be amazing. You did mention earlier about the foundation that you and your husband started, and I'd love to have you tell us a little bit more about how that started and what it is and why it's so important to you.
Yes, when my husband was working for the French doctors, he realized that he wanted to discuss more with the surgeons in the countries, and he didn't have the possibilities because very often he came, he operated, and then he went back to France. It was a very short period of time, and he had a lot of work at that moment, so there was not a real connection with the surgeons there and the people there in his job. And after the 10 years we spent doing that, he spent operating, he wanted to transmit and to have surgeons coming here because the surgeons in France are extremely good. And so he decided to create his own humanitarian association. The name is Association Chirurgie Plus, Association Surgery Plus. It means that every month, he welcomes a different surgeon from a different country in difficulty, and he organized a program for him in the best surgical services in France, in Paris. So the surgeon, he has connections in different countries, and the surgeon the surgeon sent a note by email saying, I would like to learn this, that this operation is difficult, what can I do to make it easier, a lot of people are dying from this and that, I would like to learn how to operate this case and this other case. So it's extremely practical. He organized the program. The surgeon come here, as I said, for a month, and then they go back to their country knowing exactly what to do in the different cases they want to develop. So it's for surgeons that have already a certain, that are professionals, but in their countries, for example, they haven't seen this or that operation, or they don't do it that the same way than here, and they are going to spend a month with a surgeon here, sometimes with my husband when he does reconstructive surgery also, and they are going to discuss. So it's, again, it's an exchange. It's not only the surgeon who is learning to another surgeon. They are discussing, they have reunions, and when the surgeons go back to his country, he can operate, and they still discuss by email and videos and all that about all the surgeries they can do.
That's amazing.
Yes, I think it's really, as I said, very practical, very effective. The what they learn, they can put it in practice immediately. So it's really working very well, and we have been welcoming a surgeon every month for 15 years now.
Wow.
We do an event at the Hotel Maurice every 2 or 3 years, it depends. They're extremely generous, so we are able to do that there, and we have a lot of friends. It's very friendly. Sometimes the surgeons can come and they discuss their experience with the people who come. So it's really a moment of exchange, a moment of discussion. And I think that when you do a humanitarian work, it must be about that. It must be about an exchange between population and between people. And I'm happy that it's working so well, really.
Well, that's amazing. Okay, so what's your next project, Francisca?
Well, I'm preparing another book. It's not finished yet because it takes, as you know, some time to put everything together. I would like to do something more about maybe my family experiences. Of course, I want to do something that is appealing to everyone. I don't want to talk only about myself. And also, I would like to involve my mother. She's, as I said, 94 this year. And I would like very much to do something with her, maybe exchanging our experiences and talking about her time when she was traveling and her experiences, and maybe compare to mine. And I think also the bond between generations in the travel field, but also in all kind of fields, it's something that nowadays it's more and more important because, as I said, with internet, with all that, we're not talking, we're not discussing enough with other people. And I would really like to know more about how she lived and have that a sort of a book that is like a family album, but also that will speak to a lot of people because of that connection with another generation. So I would like very much to do that. I'm preparing something like that.
It's exciting. Well, thank you so much. It was such a treat to be with you.
Thanks to you. Thank you very, very much, Melissa.
Thanks so much to Francisca for joining me today. I hope her perspective on life inspires you to enjoy the present moment as you make your own travel discoveries. To learn more about Francisca and for a full list of her books, head to franciscamattioli.com. That's FranciscaMattioli.com. And stay up to date with Francisca's latest ventures by following her on Instagram at Francisca_Mattioli. Now it's time for this week's Indigari Insight.
Here are this week's Indigari Insights.
For this week's Indigari Insight, I thought I would share some of my favorite house museums and formerly private gardens. This is inspired by our conversation of the golden age of travel and glamour, but also because in recent weeks I visited some really special places, such as Les Colombières, a garden outside of Menton on the French Riviera. It was the creation of the French artist Ferdinand Bach and is considered one of the greatest examples of a Mediterranean garden. I'll be including it in my upcoming South of France update. And a few weeks ago, when I was in Paris, I finally got around to visiting Victor Hugo's former house on the Place des Vosges, which is actually near where Francisca lives. Not only does that house have gorgeous views of one of the prettiest squares in Paris, but the dining room with its wall of Chinese porcelains and panels is stunning. It reminded me of how so many of my favorite small museums and gardens were passion projects of artists and collectors. Of course, just outside of Paris is Claude Monet's house at Giverny, where you can see the house and his garden of water lilies and the bridges that he captured in many of his paintings. Another house that I love in France is in the south, near Cap Ferrat, and that is the Villa Carolos. This stunningly sited villa on a promontory in Beaulieu-sur-Mer was the labor of love of archaeologist Theodore Reynac. Built between 1902 and 1908, the villa is a faithful recreation of an aristocratic Greek villa on the island of Delos from the 2nd century BC, but with modern amenities. So, for instance, the bathrooms are tiled in Greek style, and the tubs are carved of solid marble, but the water comes up from below grates as it would have in thermal baths. Among the treasures is also the furniture, which was commissioned by the villa's architect. Pieces are exact replicas of ancient Greek items, but were made by the era's top French cabinet maker, Bettenfield. There's a great audio tour, and adults and kids will both be fascinated as you learn about domestic servants, children's schedules, and why the dining room is set up with long chaise-like chairs. Hint, the Greeks took their meals lying down. Those interested in design will marvel at the decorative ceilings and the inlaid mosaic floors. It's really an incredible spot. Another place that I love and is very popular with designers and decorators and architects as well is the Sir John Soane Museum in London, where I was last week. The former private home of British architect Sir John Soane has whimsical multi-level interiors, and it's been left almost exactly as it was when Soane died in 1854. An avid collector of art and sculpture, Soane, who was a neoclassical architect best known for the Bank of England, filled his picture gallery to the brim with works such as William Hogarth's satirical series, The Rake's Progress. There's also amazing sculptures, antiquities, and architectural drawings and models on display. In Marrakesh, another one of my favorites is the Villa Oasis, which was the former home of Yves Saint Laurent and Pierre Berger. It's not a museum, but we can arrange visits, and I love both the house and the garden here, as well as the garden next door, which was created by artist Jacques Majorelle, and which Berger and Yves Saint Laurent preserved. I also love Lotus Land, which is the fabulous Montecito estate that was the personal preserve and paradise of the flamboyant opera star Madame Gana Walska. On 37 acres, she created her own eccentric Eden, which Connoisseur magazine declared America's most exotic garden. It's really more like a collection of gardens. And then up the coast, of course, there's the amazing Hearst Castle, one of the largest and most extravagant private residences ever built in the U.S. Hearst Castle, as it's now called, was the monumental pleasure palace built by publishing tycoon William Randolph Hearst on his family's massive cattle ranch. He began the project in 1919 when he was 56 years old. And with architect Julia Morgan, they worked on Casa Encantada, as they called it, for 28 years. The vast property, which is still surrounded by the Hearst Cattle Ranch, and when you visit, you can actually buy Hearst steaks at the visitor center, once housed the largest private zoo in the world. And when Walt Disney, Clark Gable, and Bing Crosby all came to visit, they would pass zebra, giraffe, even polar bears on the grounds. The house has 165 rooms, 38 bedrooms, 42 baths, and 14 living rooms. It would take hours to tour the entire residence.
So today, visitors choose from five different tours of the estate, ranging from a self-guided one of the gardens and grounds, and a 1 hour and 15 minute tour, which includes some of the famous pools, a guest house, and some of the first floor rooms, such as the living room, dining room, and the movie theater. There's also a 4 hour private tour that you can book for a small group. I hope this helps you find a slice of history to visit. I have lots more of these, which I will round up in an article for the Indigare website soon. But I'd also love to hear your favorites. Some of those suggested to me recently via Instagram were Villa Planchet in Caracas, Mario Praz in Rome, and the jeweler Janet Mavick suggested the Ruggles House in Maine and Giorgio De Chirico's house in Rome and Leighton House in London. If you have suggestions for me to add, please send me a DM on Instagram at Indigare Founder. Before I end today's episode, I want to share a recent news update from the Department of Transportation that I hope gives you peace of mind for any unexpected, hectic travel days. If you've ever had a flight canceled or delayed and found that it was not easy getting your money back, that is about to change. The DOT is now requiring airlines to send automatic cash refunds to passengers for canceled flights and delayed flights over 3 hours domestically and over 6 hours internationally. It does not matter where the flight was purchased. For example, directly from the airline or from a travel agent or a third-party site. The refund must be issued within 7 days if you choose to not accept alternative transportation or travel credits. This new rule is the largest expansion of passenger rights in the Department of Transportation's history, and an important move in protecting airline passengers. I hope you keep this in mind the next time your travel day does not go as planned, and see it as a silver lining. Thanks so much for joining me in another episode of Passport to Everywhere. Coming up, I'll be speaking with activist Princess Mabel of the Netherlands about her foundation, Vow for Girls, which is dedicated to protecting girls' rights and ending international child marriage. I'll also talk to John Hardy about finding inspiration in Bali, and another Indonesian-based trailblazer, James McBride, about the transformative hotel Nihi Sumba. Thanks so much for listening.
Thank you for joining us at Passport to Everywhere.
We hope you'll join the journey and subscribe. For more travel inspiration, visit indigare.com. Indagare. This has been Passport to Everywhere.